This guy's a rice guy, and he has rice he won't even sell to other people.
I'm Austin.
And I'm Cloud.
This is We Watch Movies.
Today's film is Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is a 2011 documentary film directed by David Gelb. What was the thing we said? A premise summary? I think something like that. How about a premise summary anyway?
Well, our film crew goes to the little restaurant ran by Jiro and his oldest son as they explore what it takes to make a 3-star Michelin restaurant worthy sushi from the beginning to the market to even spending 10 years just so you can make some eggs.
Yeah. Isn't it actually the middle son? Because isn't the oldest son like the old son that looks like a lot like him when they go back to like the hometown?
That was the oldest son. He's only got the two. Because when they go back to like visit with his friends, his oldest son goes with him.
Yeah,
and they're like,
well,
yeah,
I know the son that works at the restaurant with him went, but I thought he had like the son that was the older of the two that we see for most of the movie.
That was him.
And then there's the other one that runs the like other branch.
No, that's the youngest son, and he's the one that started doing stuff on his own. Because his dad kicked him out. It's like, all right, you're on your own. Don't fail. Because
was there just some other old guy that looked kind of like both of them? Because there's like they say something to him, and there's a guy on screen, and then they pan to the son.
Yeah.
And I thought the other guy was also a son.
No, that was the friend that he went to visit.
That was a friend.
Yeah, because they went to go visit a friend, and that was him. And they were like, oh, yeah, like we were the worst troublemakers in school. He was number one, I was number two. And the friend says he looks just like you.
No, I know about
you.
That friend.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that was the same guy that was the guy that we first saw. And the timing of the subtitles made it seem like that was who was being talked about as the oldest son.
Well, technically, he is the oldest son.
Well, no.
But that's the guy they pan to, who does look like him.
Yeah, but that's not the guy who was on screen when they said it. That's who I thought was the son. I thought there were three sons. It was just an old son that we didn't know about for most of the whole thing because he's extra old and he doesn't work at the restaurants anymore. Because he could have an older son because he's in his 80s. And the oldest son 85. Is only in his 50s, and so there could be an older son than that.
Well, no, because that's the thing, is the oldest son is supposed to take over the business.
Yeah, that was why it was confusing, but...
Because, like, from what they show, there's only two sons. The oldest son is supposed to take over the business, which they do describe. Like, they talk about that, you know, the oldest son is supposed to replace his father, so he wasn't jealous of his younger brother going out and starting his own business. And then we see the younger son actually out there doing his own business.
So I don't really have a whole lot to say about this thing because I don't have like a stake in the, you know, alleged bogativity of the idea the way that I did in the Polaroid one. I don't know like anything about sushi, so I can't like argue. The only I could argue like abstract things, like I think the like culture of Japan is kind of disagreeable with the even just what you just said, like the son has this like responsibility that he can't really get out of, or shame and so forth, and all of the like it takes this many years to do this or that, and you do it just like the masters, except he got to be who he was by doing other things, and now there's all of these other people that are just trying to do it the way that he does it because he's really good at it and he's respected for it.
Well, one
so
of
that
the...
seems like a bit of point missing by everyone around.
Well, one of the things that I had noticed just between this documentary and then so many other things that I've watched in the past is that when it comes to not America, it does take forever to actually be recognized.
I think it takes unnecessarily forever.
Yeah, because, like, I don't understand, because, like, they talked about, now, specifically, they said that you're supposed to hand the customer a hand-wringed hot towel. And the point was that you were supposed to, like, it's supposed to be, like, 100% clean, and it comes from, like, this boiling hot water, and you're supposed to take it, and you're supposed to wring it by hand, and when it no longer hurts, then you're ready to go to the next step. And the next step that they said was to prepare the egg, which is like this super thick, fluffy egg sheet that they have like this very specifically square frying pan, if you will, that they use to prepare the egg. But that's the thing that kind of gets me is like, what if, like, now I'm just saying, like, I'm already of an age where I could have spent time preparing myself to feel pain via heat. But like, let's say I was 15. And I'm already used to sticking my hands into this super hot water because maybe I had to wash clothes by hand. I didn't have a washing machine. So I'm already used to sticking my hands into this excruciating hot water. And it's just like, all right, well, you have to be able to handle at least handing customers this hot, hot cleaning cloth. And then if once you're ready, once you've done that and you're good enough to handle this without it killing you, then you can move on to the next step. Like,
except that doesn't seem to have any bearing at all on the rest of the process.
Exactly.
Because you never touch anything that's uncomfortably hot again. And why would you? Because it seems like if you're just touching things hot enough to hurt you, you're cooking wrong.
Well, the closest thing I can see that is that they use really, really small grilling apparatuses.
Yeah.
So I can understand, like, you're right there in the fire. Because, like, you're not cooking something for an extremely long period of time. You know,
no,
it's normally only, like, a minute. But at the same time, like, that is a fire that you're, like, in. Now, granted, I have stuck my hand in fire, but if you do it correctly, you will not get burned.
Yeah.
Kids, do not stick your hand in fire. No. That it's a good way to burn yourself.
And they are getting burned.
Yeah.
Like, deliberately. Like, all of the stuff just seems like a form of gatekeeping. And it's just like, and I understand it's so built into the culture and it's something I can't possibly understand. But I just so disagree. Like, no one would say, like, if you're going to make championship barbecue, we're going to, like, wrap an ear of corn in foil. We're going to put it on the grill for a long time and then hand it to you. And when you can handle that, then you can start making barbecue. Because it makes no sense. It doesn't have anything. It doesn't have any bearing on it. And it doesn't. Actually, even the once he had been there long enough, one of the younger apprentice guys, but not the youngest one, because he's still been there 10 years enough to be allowed to make the egg.
Oh, you're talking about the one guy that started his own business.
The guy that's still there. Or was that the guy that did have his own shop?
So there was a guy.
The guy that tells the story about making the egg over and over and that it was always wrong. And
that's
the
guy.
The other restaurant guy?
Yeah, that's the guy who went off and did his own restaurant. Because he's not the oldest son. He's on his own.
No, I know he's not the oldest son.
Yeah.
But the Jiro keeps telling him it's wrong. You know, he makes it hundreds of times and it's always wrong. And then one time it's right. But.
And then he almost cries.
But suppose that some of those other times were perfectly fine, but just different. And that it wasn't the way that Jiro wants it to taste. But it doesn't mean that it's invalid. But it is invalid because it's not what Jiro says. But that's totally against what he did in the first place. Because he looked around at all the stuff the masters were doing and they had said, you can't do anything different than this. We've been doing it thousands of years and it's done. Just make it this way. And he said, no, I'm going to make it this other way. And I'm going to make up all these other things that you haven't even seen yet. But no one else has that opportunity anymore because Jiro is already the master and he's like the last one of the classic kind and everyone just wants to be him. And there's something about that that just bothers me tremendously and seems like they keep talking about when Jiro dies, then like maybe good quality sushi will carry on, but we're not really confident in it. But they're sort of leading to it being more possible that it goes away because no one's doing it their own way, or at least those people aren't, and they're not as respected. The most respected seems to be doing it his way. Although, they say none of this is secret, really. Just other people just don't do it. But they could do it, I guess.
Well, I think the thing is like, he's like 85.
Yeah.
And so, like, when he started, because he was talking about having...
He's not dead yet, is he? Is
no,
he
he's not dead yet.
Okay.
Because
this has been a few years.
He says... Now, this is what he, Jiro says himself, that he was kicked out when he was 9.
Yeah, which okay. is also, like, really unfortunate.
Which is really sad. But, you know, this is, like, right after World War II, so apologies. But then, not for World War II, but for the fact that he was kicked out when he was 9. All right.
No. I was thinking, was it World War II, though?
Well, he was talking about in World War II that he...
I thought he was in the war, though.
Now, he was talking about how he delivered meals to the trainees. So he was probably still too young to serve.
I don't know what the rules in Japan were.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Seems like a lot of the rules kind of got thrown away towards the end. They were just kind of grabbing everyone they could.
But so from what I understand is when he was 9, he was kicked out. But if he's 85, he said he's been making sushi for 75 years. Because that's one of the last things he says at the end of the documentary. Is he's been doing this for 75 years. Now, granted, he could just be an old man and be getting his numbers wrong because he's an old man and he doesn't remember things as accurately as he used to. Mm-hmm. Or when he was about 10 or so, he did start training with somebody who was making sushi. Because that was one of the things that was brought up was, you know, like normally it was just a stand food. You know, you just go over to the stand, you get whatever kind of fish they have at the time, and then you go about your business. It wasn't a place you went and sat down like it is today.
He was born in 1925, so he would have been 20 when the war ended.
Yeah.
So he would have been old enough during the war. Yeah. So it was before, it had to be before. He wasn't 10 years old during the war.
And so he goes through all this stuff. And so I'm not gonna debate on any kind of training that he has. I can only discuss what he says and what other people's accounts are. Because he talks about having learned from people and then he improves and he wants to do better. And so I feel that there was a certain period of time where he was almost developing his own particular style based off of what he was taught. Because he says that, like, yeah, there have been people doing this for thousands of years, and you can't get any better. And he's like, but I still need to make even better. And so, like, I guess, like, that's the general concept is, like, there's this way, but we can make this even better, whether it be a higher quality ingredients, being more meticulous. You know, instead of massaging the octopus for 30 minutes, we'll massage the octopus for 40 minutes. Whether we're going to marinate this for 3 days or if we're going to marinate this for 5 days. I guess the general technique is still the same. It's just the period of time, how it's implied, anything like that. Because now, like at least for America as the states, you can go to a culinary school, spend maybe 2 years and then come out of it and be able to get a job, like, okay, you're going to be recognized to some degree depending on what you're doing.
Well, there is, even in all, like, professional cooking, largely France is to blame for the structure that everyone uses. But there is still a, like, a progression from just, like, you're starting out and you're working in the kitchen and then you move up through the levels and actually being, like, a chef, like, the chef, the head chef of the kitchen. Is like a big deal and it's a high title and it takes a long time to get there. But all of that is still just sort of just as artificial and bogus in a way because it's so structured and things are not the same. People are not the same.
Yeah.
And you might be and it's not really there outside of cooking in just like broadly in the world. Like you still have sort of, you know, electricians and carpenters and stuff. You have apprentices and levels up to master, but there's not really so much it has to be this period of time before you can move up to the level.
Well, see, that was something. It's like, because they say 10 years.
If you're good enough, then now you're good enough. And maybe it took you a year to get good enough, and maybe not.
Well, like they say 10 years, but whenever we are shown a younger person who they interview, and he's like, yeah, I've been doing an apprenticeship here, and I've been working on this and all this. And, like, he never says that he had to do this for 10 years before he could do that. Like, we're told it takes 10 years. Like, that's what we're said as a general statement within this in this documentary. But the guys never say how long it actually takes them to do anything before they move up. So I'm wondering if, like, the 10... Because, you know, they're like, oh, how? What was the shortest apprenticeship? Like, is a day. Like, he came in, and by sunset, he was gone. And so, like, I'm wondering if... how accurate that 10 years really truly is comparatively. Because, like, what happens if you get somebody who's, like, amazing? Like, it takes them 1 year, and they can do everything perfectly. Like this is how I want it done, and they can do it.
Well, I don't know. I feel like there are two ways that it could go. Either they stay there, and he continues saying it's not good enough for a long time because that's the way that he is and the way the structure is, or they get sick of that and they just go off on their own much earlier.
Maybe.
But, which is probably fine, because there's no, I don't think there's any, you don't have to work for Jiro or have his approval in order to be a great sushi chef, or you shouldn't. And if you do, because that's the opinion of other people, then they're contributing to the problem also. Because, I mean, sure, probably. I'm sure it's very, very amazing sushi. I couldn't have any opinion on it because I would just be like, okay, I have nothing to compare this to. You know, if we just went to Japan and made reservations a month ahead of time and we went and ate, it would be wasted on me because I wouldn't have any perspective. I wouldn't know. And so there's inherently an elitism to it about it from both sides, because people sitting around are either just pretending that they understand how great it is because everyone else is sort of nodding to each other about how great it is, and it's so well known, or they're like really high level sushi eaters as much as he is a high level sushi chef. And so then it's he says, we're not trying to be elite, but that's not really true, because they're doing a lot of artificial restriction. There's only 10 seats in the restaurant, and you have to have reservations well ahead of time. I do like that they only book it a month in advance. So yeah. It's like it starts over every month and you have another chance, rather than just being like, you know, trying to get into Club 33 at Disney and it's, you know, you can't even get on the waiting list for like 25 years out.
Yeah,
and it's just like, I don't like stuff like that at all, where there's just no chance.
Well, I disagree with the perception of it being elitist, because like I can understand, like, if for some reason Jiro dies,
it may not be elitist, but it is elite.
Yeah, well, I think that's just more of like circumstance has created it to be this way. Like, it wasn't their doing; it just kind of was thrust upon them. Because if you have a couple dudes who are like, we only have enough money to open this shop and it can only be this size because we're poor and there's not a lot of space, but we are going to do our absolute best to make the best product we could ever possibly make ever. And somebody walks in, sits down and is like, whoa, this is the best thing ever. And that person tells another person who comes in and they have the same response, and it's going to grow because they themselves, as long as they keep pushing themselves to be the best they can ever be, and people realize this, even if it's fake, even if they have no idea, like you said, like it'd be wasted. Like, you could have somebody who goes in and doesn't understand what good or bad really is, and they'll say it anyways because that's what everyone else is saying. They themselves haven't created this elitist profile on them. Someone else has, and they just wanted to be themselves. So if they don't expand, if they don't grow, and they only have 10 seats, I'm not going to have a problem with that, because they're not doing it on their own. Other people are doing it for them.
Well,
kind of like the one guy who's like, I'm a food writer and there's nothing better than Jiro.
Yeah.
And like, I if you want to say like he's part of the problem, I'll agree with you.
Well, he is part of the problem. For sure.
But I think something that this documentary does kind of lack is the perspective from not 3-star Michelin people, where it's just like, you know, this is like, because they talk about conveyor belt sushi being kind of a problem because that creates a lot of demand.
Only in the context of that, that's why the fish is in shortage.
Exactly.
They don't really talk about it in the like
quality aspect.
Yeah, people don't care about it as much. Or, I mean, it also seems like it kind of should matter because they spend a lot of time with. There's so much segmentation. Like every person is like, they're the best this. You know, we're the best sushi chefs. He's the best salmon guy. He's the best tuna guy. This guy's a rice guy. And he has rice he won't even sell to other people because he knows that it's the best rice and it's only for Jiro, which I think is just kind of it must be an exaggeration.
Well, I'm going to say
how much difference
is,
can there be in rice?
I'm going to say it is an exaggeration. Like, that's not a joke. It is an exaggeration. It's the idea behind, I'm the guy who sells rice to Jiro. These are people wanting to buy my rice, but I'm not going to sell it to you just because you know who I am or know who Jiro is. So I'm going to blow smoke up your ass. Like, that's what this is. That's why he's laughing the whole time he's saying it. It's because he knows he's full of malarkey.
But the guy that they buy tuna from.
Now, that's real.
He goes and walks around and he's like, I only buy like very particular tuna. So,
like, he's not the only. I know six other guys.
But if he's doing that, then it's like, well, there's plenty of the crap tuna that can go to the conveyor belt places.
Yes.
So that's not getting used up instead of going to Jiro. I mean, I understand the overfishing to try to just get as much of it for the demand. And so the small fish get picked up too, and they don't get to get big enough and old enough where they become the good fish that the guy will buy. But it's.
Well, like, now that it's one of those things where like you have different vendors and it's not just for Jiro. Like, it's just the vendors do it themselves because that's their job. But you will have vendors who like specialize in one type of animal.
Yeah.
They'll be known as like the best eel, the best shrimp, the best lobster, the best clams, just because it's the only real way in today's market for them to maintain a job to keep their families fed. And it's kind of sad that this has to be a thing, but at the same time, it does raise the level of quality that one must maintain, which is kind of the good portion of it. But at the same time, it's just like, you know, I want to go. I want to go because, one, it's like the world's largest fish market, and two, I'm sure it smells amazing because I do like the smell of the sea and of various sea life.
Aye, the smell of the sea.
Yeah. So, like, none of that's really going to bother me so much. But at the same time, it's like that experience of just being there and seeing these people do this craft. You have, like, the giant auctions for the fish and everything, and those fish are huge.
I don't understand the auction process at all, because it's almost like they break into song. It's very sort of, like, rhythmic and musical.
It's because of those,
like,
bloody bells they kept ringing through
more,
the thing.
Well, not even... I mean, the bells are one thing, but then, you know, we have what we think of as like an auctioneer, and there is like sort of, there's like a speed to it, there's a rhythm, there's a particular sound, but these guys are like, it's like slow and they're drawing things out, and it is almost musical sounding in a way. It is almost like they're singing, and I don't know anything about Japanese fish auctions.
Like, some of the dudes were like standing over the fish they wanted, and you could like see them. Like, they don't have like a flag or anything. They'll have like their pin book or whatever.
Yeah, I know they were going around like putting stickers on the fish or something.
Those are the ones that are sold. Those are sold. Yeah, I know a little bit.
And I guess they have like people's vendor numbers or something on them, so they know who bought what.
Yeah, and from my understanding, a random person cannot go in and just buy a fish at the auction. Like, you have to, proper representation and proper papers, and you got to be recognized, and then you got to be linked to some kind of vendor for specific stuff, and you got to, ridiculous.
It does almost seem like you might not even be able to walk into the fish market and buy fish if they don't think that you're special enough.
Yeah.
But there is a weird moment. It's later in the thing, but it is, we come back to the market, and there's a weird, it's in where they're talking about how the fish are being overfished and dying off, and there's kinds you can't get anymore, and then there's just this long moment where there no one says anything, where there's just like forklifts pushing together a pile of styrofoam fish coolers, and it's this weird, like, what am I supposed to take from this? Is like, are they going to dump them in the ocean in a second? And like, that's going to be contributing to the loss of the fish too? Or why are we seeing this? Or is it just to show how much fish they sold so that there's this much demand and that's what's causing the fish to go away?
Well,
I wasn't sure what it meant.
It's not so much the fish are going away. It's like they were very specific on the quality. Because like that was the whole point behind everybody that we get to see. Like, they only buy the absolute highest quality. When they see something in particular, they always think of Jiro because it's like, we want to provide him the best so he can continue to be the best. And so, like, I'm sure there's the various fish that he's like, I'm used to getting this, but the qualities went down and my people quit selling it to me because they can't find the quality because the overfishing. And then we see, like, and whenever we say it's a large pile, that's not a joke. Like, this pile is ridiculous.
It's
like,
a large, I mean, like, it's a, you need forklifts for this size pile.
Yeah. Like, this,
That's what it is.
It's a big pile.
It's a big pile.
And no, it doesn't get pushed off into the ocean.
No, it doesn't. But that's almost what it seems like.
Yeah.
Like, what does this mean? And there's sort of melancholy music underneath it.
Rick and Morty.
He will still be the best, though. Like, if the quality of fish goes down and they're still giving him the pick of the best fish they can find, and then he's still making the best sushi out of anyone that's making sushi, he's still the best. The like maximum amount of bestness is just a little lower,
yeah,
than it was. Which, this whole idea of bestness anyway, I feel like the difference between this is a really, really good fish and this is a like a Jiro level fish is not much, probably, and is probably really like you need those like elite taster types in order to even notice. Like,
yeah,
probably no one is going to notice.
Yeah,
but
I can stand with that.
And so, like, now, I don't really care that much about having the best something. Like, that might be, you know, an experience to say that you had, but just having a really, really good something, I'm just fine with, because also, qualitatively, bestness of things that are subjective, like taste, it seems to be a bit difficult to say anyway.
Well, I know, like, things like that can be subjective because it's all going to be on personal preference. But whenever you do start to experience different places and different pieces and everything, then you kind of acquire the taste, and you know what you like and what you dislike, and then you start ordering it from various places and all this kind of stuff. And then you build up an experience so you can have a better understanding. Now, like we had said previously, the thing that this lacks is exterior recognition. Because we get the writer, we get the two sons, we get Jiro himself, we get one of the apprentice, and then we get the sellers, the vendors.
Uh-huh.
But we don't get any other sushi people who didn't train. And I think that's kind of important because, like, I've never had his sushi, but I've had sushi I've enjoyed.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean it's the best, but I still personally enjoyed it.
I think that's enough.
And agreed. I do think it's enough. Now, granted, if I had a shit ton of money, because it's like $300.
Well, that is the other thing. Is
per seat.
He says, we don't care about money. We're not trying to be elite. We just want to make good food for people. He doesn't have to charge that much.
No.
There's no reason to charge. And also, he can't possibly care about money anyway because he doesn't do anything but work.
Yeah.
There's no reason for him to charge anything except this, that they have to buy the stuff to make the food with and pay the apprentices, because
now,
he doesn't do anything but go to work.
Now, that is something I am a little more interested in, because I know, like, different seafood, depending on how you purchase it, the price can vary, because, like, some of those tuna,
yeah,
will be,
it's
like,
market price.
It'll be like $30,000 for, like, one of those tuna.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you've never seen an actual tuna in person, when I say they're big, I'm not joking. Like, these things can be like 300 pounds big after they've been cut open and gutted.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about sea tuna.
Yeah, like, these things are big. Like, that little chunk that you can get at your market, like, is nothing compared to the size of one of these bloody tuna. And so, like, it being $10,000 to $20,000, like, I can understand that they're going to be expensive because you're going to get a lot. It's like buying a cow. It's essentially,
yeah,
it's
is,
buying a sea cow is what you're getting. It's just a cow that can swim that doesn't look like a manatee.
Yeah. They don't buy a whole one every day, though. They don't
exactly
make enough sushi to need it, because I guess He's the guy that comes in that is not qualified to eat there at all.
No.
He walks in with a kid. He wants a brochure. He wants to know if they have appetizers.
He had a kid?
Like, didn't he have a kid? I thought he had like a really little kid that he was like was walking next to him and he was holding. You could only see it when he went in and out of the front door.
I didn't even notice the kid.
I knew
there
he was
had
a kid, like a
on.
Really young kid. Maybe not, but I was pretty sure it was a kid.
I was too busy looking at his purple backpack.
But
he's like, "Do you have a brochure? No, we only have business cards. Oh, can I get one? Yeah. And like, what about reservations? Like, oh, it's a month in advance. All right." And it's like, it's gonna be like $300 for a seat.
He's how we learn like, all of the like the rules of eating there.
I also feel that guy's fake.
Well, he could be fake.
Because, like, they talk about, like, Jiro being on TV, so people come in, like, you're going to tell me just some random...
Well, he says he came a long way. He came from some far-off place that he says the name of, but I don't know.
And you're going to tell me this guy who comes from a far away doesn't know who this dude is in this specific location?
Or that he needs... that he can't go... Like, he's going to have to come back again in a month, because that's how far out reservations are?
Like, you're going to be telling me this guy don't know what's up. Like, I'm sure he's fake. Like, they put some dude, and it's like, hey, you want to make, like, $50? I need you to be on camera for, like, 2 minutes. Say this, please. Thank you. Have a good day.
But he does, he asks if they have lunch and dinner, and they say yes. But now I don't know if that means they serve two meals a day. Like, they have, like, one group of 10 for lunch and one group for dinner, but they're only there for, like, 20 minutes or something. So... You could have, you know, a few waves of people. I don't know. The only time we ever see any people actually eat there is the one group of people and the critic guy. And we don't get to talk to them or anything, which would be another opportunity for external perspective.
Yeah.
There's just an awful lot of everyone just saying how great Jiro is, including himself. Because like he seems to know that he's great and is with it.
He doesn't say that he's great. He says I'm going to continue being as good as I can be, and then everybody else is being like, but he's the best.
Yeah,
like I'm going to give him some credit because he never says the only thing he ever takes direct credit for is like I was the second best troublemaker ever growing up.
Yeah.
Like that's the only thing he directly takes credit for. It's like no, he was one, I was two. Recognize.
I do feel sort of bad for him because in addition to the just sort of strict cultural things about Japan itself, he basically kicked out of home at 9 and just had to do work. And that seems to have had a great deal of influence on his thinking since that point. Because he has this whole like, it should be that the kids shouldn't have any other option to succeed. And when parents are soft on their kids and tell them they can come back home if they're whatever they want to go off and do doesn't work out, then that's why they don't succeed. And I don't think that that's true because there's all kinds of reasons why you might succeed or not. And you could go out and dad says you can't come back and you still don't succeed. It's still no guarantee of anything. And you can work as hard as you could possibly can and still not succeed. Like, there's so much involved in just happening to succeed.
I think the only reason this kind of works, though, is because both of his sons have succeeded.
But they've worked for him.
Technically, yes.
So,
but at the same time, what about his wife? Like, we don't ever see anything with her.
No.
And that's something I would like to see. Like, how is she
treating
this?
She's only even mentioned once.
Yeah.
Right near the end when he's talking about how he could have retired a few years ago, but if he had, then she would have run him out of the house because he would just be bothersome because he would be driving himself and her crazy.
Yeah.
That's the only time we ever hear that she even exists. Otherwise, as far as we know, his sons just came into being independently somehow because
it's like, there's mom, never who is any the strange mention of man his wife. Asleep.
There's never any. Oh, that's right. They do mention mom, but. But we don't see her, as far as I know, even in pictures or anything. Maybe she didn't want to be seen. I don't know.
Maybe.
But there's a moment where he kind of smiles, and I kind of feel bad for them because he says, "I let them finish high school." Which, first off, that's not the right way to think about that. But and then they wanted to go to college. And I told them they were coming to work at the restaurant instead. And now they're both still there. And now maybe they've made they've found a way to be happy with it. And it's what they've both been doing it for like 30 years now, too. But it sort of seems like they didn't really have much choice.
No, probably.
And
not.
So I don't like, I appreciate in a way while also not appreciating the like elitism and bestness of it, of what Jiro did, but I don't really like him as a like a person for like all kinds of reasons. And I don't think he's to blame for any of those things, really, because I think he was sort of created by his circumstances.
Yeah, see, I kind of agree with you on that.
I still don't think that he's very...
like, him as an...
He's a person to admire, I don't think. I wouldn't...
Him as what he is can be likable, but him as the person in general, I probably wouldn't like either. Because, you know, because, like, yeah, it's like, you know, you have him as the human being element. Uh-huh. And that's probably what we're not going to like. But then you're going to have him as, like, I'm a chef.
I think it also probably doesn't matter because it's gonna be you're like. Not just going to hang out with him because he doesn't hang out. He just works.
He just works, sleeps, and then every so often on Sunday he goes and visits his friend.
Yeah. Although they made it seem like it was, like, this is the first time in 50 years because there's, like, a date. It's, like, on such and such a date, he went to the town to visit his old friends from school. And it seems like this is for the first time ever kind
of
thing.
In color.
And, I mean, he looks real dapper while he does it, but...
Very dapper.
It's, and I kind of feel bad for him... In his stringentness also, with himself, like he stands in the same place on the train platform every day, does everything exactly the same every day. And it doesn't, that seems like, I guess he doesn't know any different. And he at least thinks that he's happy doing it because he's been doing it all these years. But that sort of, also it's a, his, the thing that begins the whole thing, he stands there and says all of this stuff about how, like, you should find the thing that you're going to do as your occupation, and you should focus on that and do it as well as you can, and sort of exclude everything else and do it like as long as you can and make it as best as you can. And that's a very, like, your life is your career kind of thing, which is also, unfortunately, kind of an American thing, or at least has been for the last, I don't know, maybe 60 years or something. And it's a very non-European thing, but it is a very Japanese thing, and I think maybe some of the other Asian countries also, where there is a very, like, your position is very tied up in who you are and how you're identified and what your status in society is, and probably leftover stuff from the old, like, class caste kind of systems that, even though they don't really use that anymore, there is still a very class structure kind of thing that goes on, at least at a certain level in the culture.
One of the things that I had noticed would be that when it comes to work, it doesn't matter if it's like, if you work for a fast food restaurant, if you work for essentially a quickie mart, like, it doesn't matter what your job is, you should be, like, the best at your job. And like, even if you, like, don't want to do it as your career, you should always be the best.
Well, I think you should always try to do good work.
But see, that's the difference. There's a difference between just doing good and being the best. And I think, like his, because he is of that generation, just having been put into something that he did want, like, he chose to do this, like, because he's kicked out. He wasn't kicked out and told, do this job or you're going
to
die.
He had to do some kind of work,
and
that was what he picked.
Yeah, and that's what he picked. And he seems to be okay with doing it just from when he was a kid. But it's that mentality of, you know, you have to be the best. So he gets put into it, and he practices it, and then he ends up being good. And then he does end up becoming the best, quotations. And so it's like that kind of helps perpetuate that mentality. And so, like, when you have this as, like, a social structure where whatever your job is, always be the best at your job, even though you're technically not the best.
No. Well, I would say do the best that you can.
I think that's more fair. I think that's more fair.
Because everyone cannot be the best, because best is inherently exclusionary. There's only one best of whatever kind of thing you're talking about. So everyone, you should try to be, I guess, I don't know. Well, should you try to be the best Quickie Mart clerk? Like, what does that even mean? What are even the qualities? Like, how are you going to judge that? And
my shelves are full. I am super friendly and everyone leaves with a good day.
Which is something, and again, that's elitist about that, just the whole, that whole method of thinking, where just the, that not every job is something that there's even that kind of structure to. Sushi making is a very status kind of thing. There are great sushi chefs and you have to work your way up and you apprentice and there's lots of time involved and there's lots of technique in getting it just so. But not every job is that way.
No.
And so to say, if you're not getting that out of your job, somehow that's invalid, which he doesn't say. He just seems to blanket everything. Like, if you have a job, your job should be, like, you should be the best at that job you can. It should be your whole life. And that the work to the exclusion of the rest of your life is something that I rail against in general, because you kind of didn't, like, you only half existed. Like, you just spent your whole life doing work. And what was it for, really? And now he has given, I don't, you know, whatever, I guess, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe, just from the restriction of the amount of people that can fit in the restaurant, a really amazing, you know, best quotations, sushi experience. And that's not nothing, I suppose, that he is doing something that is making other people's lives better. But no one else really seems to be doing that for him, because there's no opportunity to. And so he's just the single-mindedness of it. Like, I go to work, I can't do anything. But now, like, my granddad was like this too. He didn't have, like, one thing that he did. He did a few different things throughout his life. But whatever he did try to do the best that he possibly could and worked himself basically to death, in the sense that he always worked. He didn't know what to do when he wasn't working, except that he did also like to fish. And those are the only two things. Either he liked to fish and he liked to work, but he couldn't fish for too long because then he just wanted to get back to work anyway. So he just sort of, that was the only thing that kept him at all, was just like, he could only work so much and then he would have to fish, but he could only fish so much and then he would have to work.
Yep.
And so those are the two things that he did. And, you know, he worked right up until he really shouldn't have been working anymore and really couldn't. And but that was just what, you know, he couldn't just sit around the house, and he would have driven himself and his wife crazy and wouldn't have been happy, I suppose. But that sort of, there's a deep sadness in those kinds of people to me, just the, like, if you're not working, you're not happy. And I mean, I have that. I don't know if it's like a thing that's inherent in the, like, the DNA or something, or I don't know, but, or just growing up in the family and having it be instilled in a significant way. I like to be doing something more of the time than not. That doesn't mean going to work in, like, the job kind of way, but, like, when I'm not at work, you know, we're doing the show, or we're doing, and sometimes, you know, we're not just doing the show, we're finding ways to make the show more difficult to do. We're going to do 30 episodes in a month, and we're going to do, you know, all of these things. And
all these things.
There's, there, like, I do have a certain amount of that. I get restless just sitting around not doing anything. You know, people talk about, you know, I'm going to win the lottery and then I'm just going to sit on a beach for the rest of my, like, I don't have any interest in that. Like, you know, I'll sit on the beach for a day or two here or there, maybe, but...
But what if you could renovate the beach?
Well, I don't know what that means. And like, building a sandcastle of, you know, grand status or whatever on the beach doesn't count. Like, that doesn't... That wouldn't add work to it that
you will construct your house out of sandcastles.
No, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I would construct a house. I would be okay with that, but just the...
You will sleep on the sand.
You know, if I have more than 2 days off in a row, like the second half of the third day, I'm like, I need something to do. Like, what can I do? I gotta find something to do. And
well, like, I'm feel kind of grateful because I don't have that kind of problem.
Well, that's not to say that, like, all the time. Like, I can just sit and just, you know, waste away on the couch, just, you know, drinking or playing video games or whatever. But for there's like a limit on the amount of time that that remains enjoyable to me. So,
well, it's not so much that, it's like I have like a ton of hobbies that I can just cycle through, so I never really truly get bored of them.
Well,
so,
I feel like that's still doing something though.
Yeah, but like that's the thing, is like I don't just have like to worry
straight
about
straight out leisure doesn't. Yeah. I mean, and there are things, you know, like reading that are, you know, an engaging activity, but are still just a little bit too leisure, where like I can still only read for so long and then I'm like, I gotta do something else.
Yeah.
Usually. Now, sometimes, every now and then, you know, with particular books, that's not necessarily true.
Sometimes you just gotta like become a sushi chef.
Well, I suppose sometimes. You know, I don't have any illusions at all that we're, by any metric, the best podcast. But we try to be a really good podcast, you know, technically and content wise. We try to make a product of a high quality.
We're not the biggest, but I like to think that we are good enough to be worthy of being one of the biggest.
We try.
Yeah. Cause like we try
to improve. We try to continue improving. You know, I try to upgrade the sound. We try to figure out the structure and do things that are interesting. Look at what people seem to have liked and things that people just didn't care about at all. And like, well, maybe we won't do any more of those things that nobody cared about. You know, we're not trying to be, you know, popularity driven or give you what you think you want already, because maybe you don't know. You know, that was one thing that the only thing I ever agreed with Steve Jobs, that's not true, there's one other thing about, is that people actually don't know what they want. They only know what they know. And sometimes they might want something they didn't know they wanted yet when you give it to them. Because people get comfortable. They're like, hey, this is all right. I like this. This is nice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll have some more of that. And then you're like, but what about this that you hadn't even thought of? And they're like, you know, that's pretty good too. I'll have some of that. But they would have never asked for that. They would have never known to ask for that.
Well, like, I know this is out of the subject, but
we're out of the subject. I don't even know what the subject is.
Like, okay, so like, there's a few people who I watch that mostly they're very specifically like video game reviewers, or they'll discuss either indie games or large review games, stuff like that. And there's a few of them who say some of the dumbest things I've heard. We don't know everything.
Dozens of dumb things, yeah. Like just unbelievably dumb things that you just can't believe we said. But I do want to say this, because we go along a lot of the time, you know, this is buried 50 minutes in an episode, and we'll probably talk about it again at another time, because I think it is important to remind everyone, because I'm sure most people don't go and read the Star System page on the website. Probably most people never even go to the website. If they're listening at all, they're probably just, you know, getting the episode, and that they don't even look at the show notes because they don't know the email address is there. But we don't believe, like, the fundamental principle of the show is that we don't believe in objective criticism of artistic works. The idea of the, like, Citizen Kane is the best film ever, and it doesn't matter whether you like it or not, it's still the best, that seems to miss some fundamental point of what art is supposed to be for. Now, not that all art necessarily has to be enjoyable or a happy fun time or
super happy fun time. Super, yeah.
That's not what I mean, but just that you can have art that's really important and that you get something out of that isn't really enjoyable in that kind of, like, let's suck down some cotton candy kind of way. You know, I talked about Wind River when I saw that. That's an example of a very uncomfortable, difficult movie, but is still really good in a whole ton of ways, and that I'm still really glad that I saw. I probably won't see it again, or not for a long time anyway. You know, Castaway is a similar thing. But if we get ahead of steam often, which I'm sure we do, and we speak in authoritative tones as if we know what we're talking about and that we're saying this is how something is, that still, no matter how authoritative it sounds, just what we think about it and what we feel about it, and the whole rating system is just, this is how we felt, this is what we, how much we liked it, how much, how effective it was for us. And there's a little bit of a, like, how good was it being the thing that we think it was trying to be, but that's the closest that we get to objectively judging things. And you are totally free, of course you are, but we're totally, like, we don't hold anything against anyone for you thinking that we're totally wrong. Because I don't think we are wrong. I don't think you're wrong either. I think we just have different opinions about the thing. And because we're talking about a subjective form, there's like the whole right and wrong question goes away. And so when we say, like, this is what's wrong with this, or if it had been this way, or this is why it doesn't work, or this is how some the way this works normally and why things that do it this way are good and why this wasn't, it's still like we're drawing on experience and on the large expanse of films that have existed, only a small subset of which we've seen, including of the so-called important ones, I'm sure. But there's no...
Well,
we don't want to come off as elitist or objective or up on our high horse and say we know, and if you don't agree, we're wrong. I mean, I'm sure in the horror, like in the October episodes, there's lots of opportunity where we just didn't get it and we didn't think it was scary, but you might have. And I'm sure it happens all the time. But
because like I'm gonna argue this a little bit, because if you're able to explain why, I'm gonna give you more credit for it. But at the same time,
we're still only explaining why we feel that way.
But here's the thing. It's still being able to explain it, because like I'm going to go back and I'm going to finish my comment, because like the guy was talking about the new God of War game not being that good. And I'm like, I've played it. I love the game. I think it's amazing. It is an appropriate sequel to the original three. We don't include Ascension. Because we all understand Ascension was not good. But that's the thing. Like, he never played any of the other ones, like, at all. And he was just talking about all this stuff. I'm like, it's difficult for me to take you seriously, even though it's your opinion, because you have no experience.
Well, it's opinion in absence of experience. That's me sitting and down at Giro's. Wouldn't work.
Yeah, and so, like, if...
My opinion wouldn't matter. It wouldn't count for anything.
And so, like, in this situation, if we were both to go... And
yours would count more.
Exactly. Like having that experience, being able to explain and describe and having that background to compare and actually verbalize it or something to share the information, I think is more important than just I did this and now I'm going to talk about doing this without any direct contents or context or relation to anything prior.
Well, that's what we always try to do, is we always try to explain what we mean, to give the reasons, at least as best we understand why we think we're thinking something, and try to justify what we're saying, rather than just saying we thought it sucked and not being able to tell you why. The why is important, but the why could still be not true for someone else. So I think our opinion matters more if we do back it up and give a basis for it than someone who just says a thing outright and doesn't back it up. But it doesn't mean that it's, you know, we didn't like something or we did like something and someone else had an opposite opinion. And we both, and well, I guess all of us probably, we haven't gotten through enough of Kate's favorite 50 cards yet, or any of ours really, but we've had fewer of hers than we have the rest of us, that we all like things enough that they're in the fishbowl that almost everyone else thinks are just terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I really like Pluto Nash. Everyone hates Pluto Nash. And there are other things like that as well. And so there's enough subjectiveness in it that I just wanted to remind her, because I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and it's been kind of weighing on me that we were perhaps failing to convey the fundamental principle of the show on an ongoing basis. And just, you know, go and read the Star. I should probably update it, because it may not actually be accurate anymore. And it's been a long time since I wrote it, but go and read it anyway, at least the introductory paragraph of it, because it is sort of a large section of the philosophy of the show in a distilled way. There are other things as well, but some of which we've talked about before and some of which I'll talk about eventually. But at least that part of it is codified there in a significant way. So how do you feel about stars?
I'm going to give it 4.
I guess I'm going to give it 4 also. Oh, the other thing, like, you sort of led into it just very, like, right at the edge of that there were several times when you would say something that made what they were talking about way more clear or detailed that they just didn't say.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of times where that happens. It's just simple, easy stuff that they could have added a bit here or there to explain a little more. They're expecting you to know quite a bit already, which is
not fair.
It's not fair, and it's not really
good
best,
for making
the
a
best way to make a documentary. Yeah. No, it's like you're making a documentary. You're telling me something that I might not know something about, and so that they could have done a bit more explaining of things.
Well, like, this is not the first time I've watched this, and the first time I've watched this was, I think, back when it came out in like 2011. Because we were still in college at the time, and I didn't I knew of Sushi.
I think I remember you watching it, but I didn't watch it with you.
Yeah, because like I knew of Sushi. I had eaten Sushi. I knew I enjoyed it. I mean, it's not my absolute favorite thing ever, but there are some places that make certain things that I do enjoy more than others. But when I watched it, So the documentary itself is about Jiro and his establishment and his life into becoming what he is. It's not so much about the sushi that he dreams of. It's not so much about the shop directly as where it exists or what it does as much as the fact that it does exist and it does what it does. It's difficult for me to explain with actual words. But like upon past that and learning other things, going back and rewatching it, now I can see this person doing this and I know what they're doing. It's not explained in the documentary, but at the same time, I don't expect it to be because it's not about, like, preparing mackerel. Like, oh, yeah. Like,
no, it's
like
not things like that.
Like, we see him preparing mackerel, but they don't say he's preparing mackerel or what he's doing, but see, now I know what he's doing.
I don't expect it to be how it's made for sushi.
Yeah.
But
and so there's, like, things that are done inside the kitchen that are not directly explained, that like simple wording, like just having the person doing it, just being like, oh, this is all I'm doing right now. I got to get this ready for so-and-so. And I think that would be fine because then we know like, oh, this is the fish and this is what he's doing to the fish.
They do actually explain some things like that, though. Yeah. They talk about how they put the rice under pressure and they detail how they do it. More than they do any of the other cooking things, but yeah. They do still talk about
and
it.
And the massaging the octopus. Like,
yeah.
Like, those are the two direct focuses. Like, it's like, this is how much direct passion that we put into preparing said ingredients for said dishes. And the only thing past that is, like, they don't tell us what or how, but they just tell us that he is preparing the egg. And then we get to see him do it, and it's pretty funny.
I will say, just in fairness to the Polaroid documentary, we hit it a little hard for the amateurish Steadicam operating in the Impossible Project section.
Yeah,
in the factory, there is a little bit of that in the fish market where there's a little bit of bobbing and wobbliness, and they're using a little too wide angle a lens for that kind of rig, so it's really obvious when it's drifting around a bit. It's not as bad as it was in the Polaroid documentary, but it's still there. So, is the only time there's anything like that, because otherwise, it's really, really
smooth.
Well shot.
Yes,
and it's really nice to look at.
As like they had to have used legs for almost everything, because like there was so many just time-lapsing shots, there's no way that they had some dude with a camera on his shoulders,
really shallow focus pulls.
Like
he
had to have that as on a setup or something. But even with the market scene, I'd give him a little bit of credit for that because there was moving, Like, we did receive, like, some still shots that were a little wobbly, but there was enough moving around within the market that it didn't bother me so much.
No, when they're walking around, it's okay. But yeah. Even sometimes when they're standing, it's still doing that. Like, the head is just tilting on the axis back and forth.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's yawing is what it is. And it's not, or roll, it's roll, actually. It's not yaw, it's roll. And it's, Steadicams are hard.
Steadicams are hard.
We're going to keep saying it as we come upon it. Steadicams are hard. Which is why it's so amazing when you see someone do just a ridiculous Steadicam thing. That if you don't know that it's difficult to operate a Steadicam, you might not know. Because, you know, there's obvious things like whatever music video that's in where they do the, like, the thing from the segue from super far off and then up onto the stage and then circle around. Like, that's an extreme version that, like, anyone is going to be, like, impressed by it, even if they don't know how they did it. And although I've always hated that one in particular, while everyone else thinks that it's a boom cannon of a thing, because it was really dangerous to do and it was unnecessary to do it that way, because there are other camera, other pieces of equipment that you could have done the same effect with, and had it not be a stunt, which is what it was. It was a stunt. Look at how other camera people appreciate the stuntiness of this, and but you could have achieved the same effect other safer ways. But the only other thing that I want to say is, and I'm sure other people already know this, but why do some people pick it up with their hands and some people use chopsticks? Because it seems to not be related to the type of thing, because it seems to happen with the same things. Like, so one person will pick it up with their hand and one person won't. Is it just because they want to? Are there rules? Or...
There's technically rules, but so from my understanding of said rules, we do get to see a lady who takes a bite of umi, and it's like a whole piece, and it fits like her entire, it fits into her entire mouth.
Yeah.
And like that was like, that's the kind of the thing is you're supposed to, you take it and you put it like entirely in your mouth. You don't bite a piece of it off. You just put the whole thing in your mouth and you just chew it. Now, your hands are supposed to be clean to begin with. So normally, if you were to, you know, not make a mess and you reach up and you grab it with your hands, and like I said, you're not making a mess, then normally that's not so bad. But you can also, if you are skilled enough, use your sticks and grab it that way. Some people are, some people are not. Some places, the compression, because like the rice itself, there's an amount of compression that has to be placed onto it so it stays together, but it's not firm.
Uh-huh.
Because like you want it, you don't want it to fall apart, but you want it to stick together just enough so it falls apart in your mouth. And yeah. Any firmer is a problem.
Yeah, well, they use the baby chick metaphor.
Yeah.
Or comparison.
You got to pretend like you're petting a baby chick really hard.
It is sort of a weak metaphor, I think, because they do seem to be pressing fairly firmly. You know, they're not like smooshing it, maybe, but they're pressing a little harder than I think you should press on a baby chick. So,
The baby chick will be fine.
Yeah, they're pretty soft. Last thing, David Gelb's original nickname for the project was Planet Sushi.
That's terrible.
Well, it wasn't ever going to be the actual title, but he was inspired by the photography quality of Planet Earth, the BBC series. So he wanted to do something like that, but for sushi, which I guess he kind of did, you know, close-ups on things and pulling focus and stuff in slow motion, watching amazing things happen. So he kind of did that, but it's a terrible title for a thing.
Yes, very.
They actually basically do a roll credits, though, because he said it's not credits, but we get the title card. Because Jiro says, I used to wake up and I had dreams about sushi ideas. And then like the title card of the film comes up. Because yeah. I was thinking roll credits, and then it's like boom, title card. And I'm like,
I used to make sushi in my dreams.
Yeah.
Dun dun.
Yeah. Now he says used to. Does that mean he stopped?
Maybe he stopped dreaming.
Maybe. And so I have to say about Jiro dreams of sushi. We'll see you next time.
Later.